The Shawshank Redemption, based on Stephen King's novella, has long been ranked among the best films ever made. The movie explores themes we all struggle with, such as coping with a tragic fate and finding purpose in life, as well as the tension between accepting things as they are and holding on to hope for something better. It also contains a fantastic plot twist that often really baffles people watching the film for the first time. And to be honest, I still get goosebumps every time I watch it, even though I've seen the movie many times. It's not hard to understand why so many people love The Shawshank Redemption. Aside from the excellent acting, music, cinematography, and plot, I think the philosophical themes and how they are embodied in the characters really resonate with people. In this video, I would like to explore some of these philosophical themes in The Shawshank Redemption. We'll examine the story and its characters, delving deeper into the minds of Andy Dufresne and Alice Redding, also known as Red, and we'll explore their ways from an existentialist, philosophical perspective, as well as what they can teach us about life. My name is Stefan. This is not an AI voice. I'm a real person. Subscribe to my newsletter if you want to stay updated on all my content, and consider supporting my work on Patreon. Thank you. And I hope you'll enjoy this video. By the way, for those who haven't seen The Shawshank Redemption, this video contains spoilers. The story begins in 1947, when banker Andy Dufresne arrives at Shawshank State Prison. Andy is sentenced to 2 consecutive life terms for murdering his wife and her lover, supposedly after finding out about their affair, a crime he did not commit. Although there wasn't definitive proof, the judge decided, based on strong evidence, that it couldn't have been anyone else, and thus an innocent man got locked up for life. We're shown how a bus full of newcomers, including Andy, enters the prison complex, where both guards and inmates await them. The newcomers, referred to as fresh fish, have left behind their lives as free men, sometimes for good, and are now entering a new phase, an existence confined within prison walls, under the permanent supervision and control of prison personnel. It's a rite of passage in some sense. A transition from one world into another. The first night is likely one of the most challenging moments for these men, as it begins to dawn on them that they've lost one of the most precious assets an individual can have, which is freedom. As in, freedom to move around freely in one's country or city, the freedom to travel, to meet new people, to choose with whom to associate, and to decide, at least to a great extent, how to live one's life. The definition of freedom, of course, varies, but I think we can agree that imprisonment is generally a massive restriction of one's personal freedom. Simple things we enjoyed during our lives outside are no longer accessible to us. We can't eat in our favorite restaurants, we can't hang out with friends and family, we can't hop on a plane or go camping in the woods, and we can't even go to the supermarket anymore. Instead, our bodies are subjected to the whims of both prison guards and fellow inmates that, in the case of Shawshank at least, make up for a very hostile environment, which is very bluntly but effectively verbalized by the brutal captain of the prison guards, Byron Hadley, yelling to a newcomer bold enough to ask when they get to eat. "You eat when we say you eat, you shit when we say you shit, and you piss when we say you piss." After which he stomps him in the stomach. In prison, your fate largely depends on others. You can't leave. So if you don't like it for some reason, and people are making your life a living hell, you have to deal with it in some way or another. And in the first moments one enters Shawshank, this harsh reality hits like an atomic bomb. During the first night, we see a guy, referred to as Fat Ass, sobbing uncontrollably, crying for his mother, which ended up in a fatal beating by Hadley. From an existentialist viewpoint, being imprisoned is part of one's facticity. Most people don't choose to be in a place like Shawshank State Prison. And for Andy, being a highly educated, brilliant, successful, and relatively young man, ending up there is really one of the worst things he could have imagined happening. But it's a fact of his existence, no matter how unfair. It's beyond his control, as the ancient Stoics would say. We'll get into the concept of facticity later. After the rite of passage ends, after they've been checked for lice, walked naked to their cells, endured that first night among violent inmates and guards, their new reality sets in. The fresh fish now face a challenge, shaping their lives as prisoners. So in their unfreedom hides an inescapable freedom. Even though being imprisoned is one of the most profound restrictions on one's freedom, it still challenges the inmate to make choices and take responsibility for these choices. How will I live? How will I spend my time? How will I treat others? Will I create a meaningful purpose for myself or be a source of mayhem? Will I resign myself to prison life and just accept the facts as they are, albeit in a cynical and nihilistic way? Or will I try to transcend the reality of my imprisonment? We see different characters cope with their situations in various ways. We see the so-called sisters completely taken over by violence and lust. We see that the elderly inmate, Brooks Hatlin, has practically become part of the furniture, almost unified with the environment. Which is also clearly the case for a guy like Haywood, who simply goes with the motions and routine and his role within a group. However, the most interesting example of the tension between freedom and facticity can be seen in two initially contrasting main characters, Red and Andy, which we'll explore now, starting with Red. Alice Boyd Redding, also called Red, played by Morgan Freeman, has been imprisoned for murder and has been in Shawshank for around 20 years when the story begins. A deep friendship develops between him and Andy, revealing much about his character. He's also the narrator, giving us a glimpse into his mind. Red's first scenes set the tone of his cynicism, as his parole application is rejected. He expects the rejection, and the parole hearing appears to be an absurd, meaningless routine rather than a genuine, realistic opportunity to be released. The general attitude within the prison is revealed when Red tells a fellow inmate he's been rejected again, saying, "Same old shit, different day." The inmate responds, "I get my rejection tomorrow." Quite early in the film, we learn that Red is a well-established member of the ecosystem. He is the guy who can get stuff, be it cigarettes, postcards, toothbrushes, and other things like wallpapers of sex symbols, which he usually smuggles inside through the laundry. He fills an archetypal role, fundamental to the prison environment. In Red's own words, "There must be a con like me in every prison in America." He is surrounded by a fixed group of friends, including Haywood and Brooks. He acts like a leader of the group, and people seem to respect him, partly due to his role as a wise man and someone to turn to for guidance. He's also on good terms with the guards and even does favors for them and the other way around. He knows exactly how to behave, what to say and what not to say. Red describes prison life as routine. It just goes as it goes, often repeating itself, including the bad stuff. He points specifically to Andy dealing with consistent harassment by the sisters, led by the major antagonist, Boggs Diamond. That was Andy's routine, as Red put it. Something he simply had to endure, like the condemned king Sisyphus from Greek mythology, forever pushing his boulder up the hill. And as there is no salvation, no prospect of change, you're better off accepting the situation as it is, until it changes by the powers that be. Unsurprisingly, when Andy brings up the idea of hope later in the story, Red quickly dismisses it, saying, "Hope? Let me tell you something, my friend. Hope is a dangerous thing. Hope can drive a man insane. It's got no use on the inside. You'd better get used to that idea." End quote. So, even though Red fares pretty well in Shawshank, he's also cynical and doesn't believe in change. He has accepted an existence he never chose for, embracing the limitations placed upon him. Thinking of a life more fulfilling and worthy than the one he's been living for years is pretty much taboo. Red likely represents the majority of the inmates, with his "it is what it is, get used to it, do what you're told, and don't get your hopes up" mentality. It's a nihilistic form of realism that helps him cope. Moreover, the environment encourages such an attitude. The corrupt warden, Samuel Norton, who serves as the main antagonist of the story, emphasizes two things: discipline and the Bible. The latter serves more as a tool for control for Norton than as a guide to liberation or spiritual development. Nietzsche's idea of slave morality seems fitting here. The embrace of Christian values that, according to him, lead to self-negation, such as obedience and humility, and also the resentment that comes with submission to the masters who dominate and decide the rules, which we see play out in the rooftop scene when Haywood sarcastically mocks Hadley's troubles. However, to gain a deeper understanding of Red's attitude, let's turn to existentialism, specifically to Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. Sartre and Beauvoir distinguished between facticity and freedom. Facticity refers to everything that's given in our existence, our past, body, and circumstances, the limits we cannot change. We can't deny facticity, just as a prisoner can't deny his imprisonment, but we can decide how to relate to it. Freedom, therefore, is not the absence of limitation, but the way we respond to it. It always exists hand in hand with facticity. For the existentialist, facticity isn't opposed to freedom, but its foundation, the ground from which we transcend through action and choice. Or, as Sartre once said, freedom is what we do with what is done to us. By denying his freedom, Red became his facticity. He shaped himself according to the situation. He identifies with it, living exactly as a typical prisoner should, being a cog in the prison environment. Deep inside, he longs for freedom. But he pushes away this desire as it confronts him with the harsh reality of the walls around him. Hence, he considers hope a dangerous thing. It's a desire for something to happen, being released in his case, which may very well never occur. Hope comes with uncertainty and the risk of disappointment. To protect himself, Red gave up hope and embraced prison life, dreadful as it is, because it's predictable and thus safe from disappointment. It's his mechanism of coping with facticity. In a way, Red's attitude appears stoic. It echoes Epictetus's idea that if you don't desire what lies outside your control, like release from prison, you won't be disappointed. But deep down, he still desires freedom. He just pushes the desire away, pretending it's gone. The existentialist would argue that Red acts in bad faith as he denies his freedom, acting as if he has no choice but to play out his role. However, that begs the question, does Red really have a choice? What kind of freedom can there really be in prison when the chances of release are almost none? Yet, during his friendship with Andy Dufresne, Red encounters a profoundly different outlook, one that ultimately transforms him. Andy Dufresne, played by Tim Robbins, remains silent during his first night in prison and continues to be a man of few words during the first weeks of his stay. But after a month or so, he approaches Red, asking him to obtain a rock hammer so that he can pursue his geological interests as a rock hound. Red, clearly surprised by the request, agrees, but for a price, and warns him that the guards will confiscate it if they find it. But Andy takes the risk, which already shows his quiet determination and willingness to step off the beaten path. Red describes him more or less as an outsider, someone who doesn't belong there, strolling around, seemingly without a care in the world, as if he had an invisible cape shielding him from the place. Andy's first 2 years in Shawshank weren't enjoyable. The sisters often harassed him, resulting in bruises and visits to the infirmary. On the bright side, Andy formed a friendship with Red and gradually earned acceptance within the group. Eventually, with the help of some prison politics, Red and his friends, including Andy, get selected to work on the roof of the prison, which is a welcome change of scenery. And, for Andy, a temporary escape from the laundry, where he so often got attacked. Amidst the activities on the roof, under strict supervision by the guards, Andy takes a massive risk by approaching Captain Hadley after overhearing his troubles regarding his inheritance and the corresponding tax issues. He almost got himself thrown off the roof by Hadley until he was able to persuade him to listen to his advice. To the amazement of Red and the group, Andy manages to strike a deal with Hadley. He would help him evade taxes in exchange for beers for his friends, which shows Andy's comfort with risk and his ability to act out of the box. He made everyone happy, though he didn't drink himself. During this key scene, we hear Red wondering why Andy did what he did. Was it to make some friends? Was it to appease the guards? Or, as he suggests, was it to feel normal again? While all of this may be true, we could also argue from an existential perspective that, for a moment, Andy exercised his freedom. He showed himself and others that he is more than an object defined by his environment. Also, Andy was able to transcend his facticity, or his routine, as Red described it, of being the target of harassment by the sisters. By gaining the approval of Hadley, he turns an enemy into an ally, through which he effectively weaponizes himself against the sisters. Repeatedly, we see Andy exercising his freedom within the confines of the prison environment. He engages with his hobbies, one of which is creating his own chess pieces out of rocks. He obtains a wallpaper of Rita Hayworth, and after being transferred to the prison library to assist Brooks Hadlin, he begins to arrange tax reports for all prison personnel, including the corrupt warden, Samuel Norton, who uses his expertise for various money laundering schemes. Another great example of Andy pushing the limits of his situation is how he manages to get funds and books to expand the library against all odds. Brooks makes clear it's impossible to get funding, and when Andy wants to ask the state senate for funds directly, Norton claims it's not going to work. So Andy starts writing a letter a week until he finally, after 6 years of weekly letters, receives a collection of books and vinyl records along with a $200 check. He concludes that his persistence pays off, and he starts posting letters twice a week. Andy's ways demonstrate his patience, as well as his belief in soft and slow methods, which quite align with his interests in geology. It reminds me of the Taoist wisdom found in the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu, which speaks of the power of water, a principle that is especially evident in the story's great plot twist, which we'll discuss soon. After a new load of fresh fish arrives, Andy takes one of the newcomers, a youngster named Tommy, under his wing, who eventually turns out to have valuable information about Andy's case. He knows who murdered his wife and lover. This new information could prove Andy's innocence and result in his release. So, of course, he immediately informs Norton about it. Norton, who obviously needs Andy for his activities, refuses to help his case and even lets Tommy be shot to destroy the evidence. From that moment on, Andy has had enough. Not long after, the guards discover that his cell is empty. He's gone, disappeared in thin air. "Get busy living or get busy dying," Andy told Red not long before his escape. Unlike Red, Andy never gave up hope. He continued to believe in his chances of getting out and worked diligently toward his goal. His escape was, again, an act of patience. A quiet force, like Lao Tzu's soft water eroding stone, slow and steady, proving that gentleness and persistence can break even the thickest of walls. All it took was pressure and time. Andy's iconic escape is the ultimate exertion of freedom. The cherry on the pie, leading him to obliterate the facticity of his imprisonment and spend the rest of his life in Zihuatanejo. But his escape came with an enormous risk. He had to hide the rock hammer in his Bible, and his various wallpapers, featuring Rita Hayworth, Marilyn Monroe, and Raquel Welch, had to conceal the tunnel he was digging over a period of almost 20 years. At any moment, a surprise inspection could expose him, and the consequences would be dire. His chances of ever getting out would be reduced to zero. But had he done nothing, he would have never gotten out in the first place. So, why not risk it? Whereas Red chose the safe road with minimal risk, Andy put his life on the line and succeeded. But the story isn't done yet. Red admits he liked Andy from the start, and he must have seen something in him that's missing in himself, or at least hidden away somewhere in the shadows of his psyche. I'm talking about hope. Within the walls of Shawshank, Red never recovers his hope. And during another hearing, his belief that he'll get out is gone forever. He just doesn't care anymore and shows it. Quite paradoxically, he gets approved and is released after 40 years of imprisonment. Red steps into his freedom, but with reservations. Brooks Hadlin, released when Andy was still around, had grown so dependent on the prison walls that he just couldn't adapt to the vastly changed world outside and ended his life. Like Brooks, Red has a difficult time finding his way as a free man and often longs for life within the walls. Again, he finds himself at the mercy of the facticity of his life. But there's one thing that evokes a tiny little bit of hope, a promise he made to Andy. And thus, he finds the letter from Andy near the oak in Buxton, which turned out to be an invitation to come to Mexico. Remember, Red, hope is a good thing, maybe the best of things, and no good thing ever dies, Andy wrote. After receiving the invitation, we see Red finally exercising his freedom and transcending his facticity by hopping on a bus to the border and thus breaking his parole. After a long time, Red got busy living. He says, "I find I'm so excited. I can barely sit still or hold a thought in my head. I think it's the excitement only a free man can feel. A free man at the start of a long journey whose conclusion is uncertain." End quote. It seems he hadn't felt this way in a while. Excited, nervous, hopeful, uncertain. Red might have just experienced what existentialist philosopher Søren Kierkegaard called the dizziness of freedom. A paradoxical feeling of both fear and attraction to one's freedom and all the risks and uncertainties that come with it. And so, hope takes on a different meaning. It's not merely an expectation that things will change or a wish for fortune to turn in our favor. It's something we do. Projecting our actions onto an uncertain future, striving towards something even when we may never get what we want, and doing it anyway. Thank you for watching.